Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 188, Technology and the Evolving Brain, with Gary Small, MD. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
We know that surgeons who play video games make fewer errors in the operating room. So hand-eye coordination is improved. Peripheral vision can be improved. There's a computer program that's being distributed to older drivers in Pennsylvania, hoping that it'll help their driving skills and improve their peripheral vision. The downside is there in many ways. There's technology addiction. There are studies showing an association between too much technology and worse symptoms of ADHD. There's even controversial studies suggesting it could contribute to autism in young people. So I think we know the brain is complex, we know the technology is complex, and what we need to do is recognize the relationship and try to harness the power of the technology so it improves our brains and improves our lives.
That was the voice of my guest, Gary Small, MD, who along with his wife is co-author of the 2008 book, iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind. In addition, Dr. Small is a professor of psychiatry at the UCLA Semmel Institute and directs the Memory and Aging Research Center and the UCLA Center on Aging. He is one of the world's leading experts on brain science and has published numerous books and articles. Scientific American magazine named him one of the world's top innovators in science and technology, and he frequently appears on The Today Show, Good Morning America 2020, and CNN. Dr. Small has invented the first brain scan that allows doctors to see the physical evidence of brain aging and Alzheimer's disease in living people. Among his numerous breakthrough research studies, he now leads a team of neuroscientists who are demonstrating that exposure to computer technology causes rapid and profound changes in brain neural circuitry. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Gary Small, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
The title of your latest book is iBrain, which is someone who has an iMac, an iPod, and an iPhone is sure to get my attention. Also, after I got your book, I remembered that you were mentioned several times in the book, I Can't Remember What I Forgot by Sue Halpern, who I also interviewed some time back. And I was so proud of myself for remembering your name amongst all the other names that she mentioned throughout the book.
Well, that's great that your memory is still intact, so you could not forget that mention.
It surprised me because memory's really been a struggle for me. That may crop up again in this conversation.
Well, I think that memory is a struggle for so many of us, and I've been studying the brain as it ages for as long as I can remember, and it's really the concern of so many baby boomers and middle agers and seniors, because they notice a change in memory as they age.
Yes, boy, I certainly am noticing it myself. Then I also encountered your name more recently when a friend directed me to an article in the New York Times describing some of the recent work in your lab. It was a November 30th article of this year about your research suggesting that the brains of older adults may benefit from web surfing.
Well, this study stemmed from the research I was doing for the new book you mentioned, iBrain.
Yeah.
And in trying to understand the work that had been done already, I saw there was a knowledge gap. And the book, which looks at not just how we measure the brain's function with technology, but how today's new technology impacts the brain, it was remarkable to me that no one had studied what our brains look like when they're searching online, which is a very common computer task these days. And that's when we did that study, it really made the headlines internationally.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that some more. But before we do, just give us a bit about your background.
I'm a geriatric psychiatrist, and I studied as an undergraduate at UCLA, and I was urged to go east to medical school, so I went to USC in East LA, and then I was told, no, go farther east, so I ended up at Mass General doing a general psychiatry residency. I came back to UCLA, studied geriatric psychiatry, and was fascinated by Alzheimer's disease and brain imaging from the beginning, and have worked on that for many years, and felt that the key was to try to protect a healthy brain rather than try to repair one once it's damaged. So we've developed brain imaging technologies to detect the first subtle evidence of Alzheimer's years before people have obvious symptoms. And we've looked at genetic risk factors that will help us with that. And we've tested medicines and lifestyle approaches to try to protect the healthy brain before it declines, or try to stave off brain aging and Alzheimer's disease.
Wow. Well, before we get into the details of your book, maybe you could tell us something about research that's currently underway in your lab.
Well, we have grants from the federal government and from foundations and private donors to refine some of these neuroimaging tools. We've invented a new brain scan chemical marker that we use with PET imaging, and we're able to see the physical evidence of Alzheimer's disease, the amyloid plaques and tangles, for the first time in living people. And so we're studying people with mild memory complaints, people with different forms of dementia like Alzheimer's and frontal temporal dementia, and we're comparing this kind of scanning tool with other scanning tools. We're studying genetic risk. We're refining a test we use called the brain stress test, and we use functional MRI to look at how the brain is functioning from moment to moment while we present people with a memory task. It's analogous to a cardiac treadmill stress test and gives us quite interesting results. We also are quite interested in looking at supplements, and the one that our basic science group has been looking at is curcumin and turmeric, which is in curry spice.
Huh.
We know that in India there's a lower rate of Alzheimer's disease. They eat a lot of curry there, and this curcumin is a potent antioxidant and anti-inflammatory, and also may disrupt the amyloid plaque aggregation. So we have a lot of innovative studies like that. We have a brain boot camp that we've developed where we teach people memory techniques and healthy brain lifestyles, and we have memory training classes actually available throughout the U.S. So we like to be at the cutting edge of innovative science, and we like to translate that science into programs that we can make available now to the public.
That's terrific. In fact, that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was, you know, we hear about that we should exercise our memory just in the same way that we would exercise our muscles to stay healthy. And, you know, so I've just wondered how much of that is hype, you know, claims for mental gyms that will stave off Alzheimer's or normal forgetting associated with age.
Well, let me also disclose that I've helped several companies with brain training,
okay,
electronic devices, Radica Games, Mattel, where we developed a little handheld toy that gives you brain teasers and memory techniques, and a more sophisticated tool for a company called Dacom called the Brain Fitness System. And so in addition to the memory classes that we developed at UCLA and these more commercial types of approaches, you know, we've got to think about these kinds of techniques in two ways. First, you mentioned the possible hype, and I think there has been some hype with these devices and programs because the studies have shown have been reported as mental activity lowering the risk for Alzheimer's. And that's how it's reported with epidemiological studies, that people do crossword puzzles or read or go to college, they have a lower risk for getting Alzheimer's disease. But it's not really proof of cause and effect. It's possible that people who go to college have, you know, terrific brain genes, and that gets them on the college trajectory. I suspect it's a combination of nature and nurture. So, but we haven't yet proven that keeping the mind active will protect brain health. Despite that, many experts do recommend that people remain mentally active. We just don't want to oversell that or have people think that if they do enough Sudoku puzzles, they'll never get Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we do know that we can train people with mild memory complaints to improve their memory. And so the memory classes that we've developed, the brain fitness system from Dacom, even though that hasn't been substantiated yet, but pilot data show that it does improve memory performance, and it probably will when it gets into clinical trials. So I think there's two different types of approaches with mental exercise right now, and both have their place.
I have some friends who are big into memorizing poetry, and I'm just amazed at all the poetry that they have been able to memorize. I haven't tackled it myself, but it sounds like that might be a very good practice.
Well, yeah, I think it's a good practice if people enjoy it. But, you know, somebody came up to me once and said, "Well, Small, you know, I took up a language and I hated it. You know, why'd you tell me to do that?" I was saying try different things and do things you enjoy.
Yes.
Because that's another part of brain health, is lowering stress and trying to engage in life and have a positive attitude. Those are all good things.
Yeah. By the way, what's the spelling of that spice in curry, that curcumin that you mentioned?
It's, curcumin is C-U-R-C-U-M as in Mary, I-N as in Nancy.
Okay. Well, I'll rush out and buy a pound of it right away.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily do that, because the challenge we have right now in getting this study going is if you put curcumin into a pill, it doesn't get absorbed by the brain. But if you cook it in oil, it does. So if you get curcumin supplements, you may just be wasting your money right now. It may not do anything for you.
And you don't
Instead, go out and eat Indian food once a week. In fact, one study found that eating curried food once a week is associated with a better memory testing score.
Interesting. And as I was just listening to you, I got an idea for a cross-cultural study maybe that somebody should do. You know, there are other societies, other cultures, which are still more in the oral tradition, where people memorize vast amounts of material. And I'm just wondering if you would find less Alzheimer's and memory problems in those cultural groups.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. The trouble with those cross-cultural studies is there's so many confounding variables. They've done them. Say Hugh Henry from University of Indiana studied African Americans in Indianapolis and compared them to Nigerians, and he looked at the rates of Alzheimer's, and it was lower in the Africans than the Nigerians. And one explanation is the diet, that they have a simpler diet. It could also be more physical activity. So there's all these confounding variables, and I find a lot of times we just have to, you know, spend the money and do a clinical trial to test out these interventions.
Okay. Well, let's get into your book, iBrain. What was the stimulus for writing it?
Yeah, I think I've spent so much time with technology and how we can measure the brain with it. I was just impressed by how much all these new technologies were changing our lives, and I wondered how much are they changing our brains. And that was really what was behind it, the observations in my own life, seeing my teenage kids very adept with this technology, using it 24/7, but having a concern that it might be affecting their face-to-face human contact skills. And iBrain is really about all these issues, how technology affects our brain, how the young brain is developing and most sensitive to the technological stimulation, and And even though the neural circuits that control the tech skills are quite efficient in these young digital natives who are immersed in the technology from an early age, I'm concerned about their human contact face-to-face skills. Can they look somebody in the eye during a conversation? What about recognizing nonverbal cues and their facial recognition skills? The older digital immigrants come to the technology more reluctantly, and what I think is happening is rather than a generation gap, we have a brain gap because their brains are wired differently. And the solution that iBrain offers is to upgrade the tech skills of the digital immigrants and help younger digital natives with their human contact skills.
Yeah, that was really kind of a unique aspect of the book, I think, is that you try to intervene on both ends of the scale there. Certainly, I've noticed changes in myself as a result of technology. It's a very relevant question to me. A big thrust of the book is brain plasticity, and I think you've kind of indirectly referred to that in what you've just said. And I gather you see that as having both an upside and a downside. So maybe you could kind of talk about that, the upside and the downside of this brain plasticity.
Well, the upside is that our brains can repair themselves to some extent. So let's say you have even a digital and native or digital immigrant who's spending too much time with the technology, their social skills are suffering, you know, you can change that. You can change their computer habits. You can teach face-to-face skills, and you can see changes in the neural circuitry. The positive aspects of technology are clearly there. I mean, they've changed our lives. They've improved our social contact skills. We know that surgeons who play video games make fewer errors in the operating room. So hand-eye coordination is improved. Peripheral vision can be improved. There's a computer program that's being distributed to older drivers in Pennsylvania, hoping that it'll help their driving skills and improve their peripheral vision. The downside is in many ways. There's technology addiction. There are studies showing an association between too much technology and worse symptoms of ADHD. There's even controversial studies suggesting it could contribute to autism in young people. So I think we know the brain is complex, we know the technology is complex, and what we need to do is recognize the relationship and try to harness the power of the technology so it improves our brains and improves our lives.
Okay. You use the term techno-brain burnout, which I have to say strikes me as a bit sensational, but maybe that's necessary to sell books these days. But you're a respected scientist at a respected research university, so give us the scoop on techno-brain burnout. Some science behind that?
Well, there's unfortunately, the science is in its infancy in many of these areas. And what I try to do in iBrain is bring in as much of what we know from neuroimaging, from educational studies, from epidemiological studies, and put it together in a way that makes sense. And I think techno-brain burnout refers to that experience that we all have when we've spent hours searching online or doing email, and it kind of affects our attention. There's a level of fatigue. There's almost a temporary confusional state some people experience. And it's something that really hasn't been studied systematically. But there are other related issues. For example, multitasking. We know that has been studied in the middle-aged brain and may be related to the techno-brain burnout. And we know that middle-agers do not multitask all that well. And when they're introduced with a distractor, we see more errors than not. And so a lot of people probably should cut back on their multitasking. They have the perception that they're more efficient and they're doing more, but really they're making more errors. And it takes time to shift from one task to another rather than focus on one at a time.
Yeah, boy, I can really relate to everything that you're saying about that. I'm a person who spends way too much time on the computer. And And I have experienced probably what you're referring to as this techno-brain burnout, where I kind of hit a wall, you know, kind of late in the day usually, and I just hit a wall where I realized I cannot do another thing. I can't think anymore.
Well, I think your brain and your body is telling you stop. And what I'd like people to do by following some of the advice in iBrain is to kind of gain control of that, so you don't have to wait to that point where you're completely burned out. You know, have proper hygiene, brain hygiene when you're using the computer. Take frequent breaks. Get up and stretch. I've done this myself where I get kind of lazy and I'm doing the email, and rather than get up and take a break and talk to someone in the office next door, I just send them another email.
Yes.
Whereas or another thing to keep in mind is, what is the best form of communication for what you're trying to accomplish? I see these strings of email conversations among colleagues, and I'm thinking, this is not getting anywhere. People can't keep track of it. Let's schedule a brief meeting and get together. We can solve this in 2 minutes.
Right, right. Coming out of a university environment myself, one of the impacts that listeners will have heard me refer to before is when I first started my academic career, as you walked around the university and looked inside offices, you would have seen people talking to each other. You would have seen faculty speaking with students. Today, when you walk around probably most any university and you look in open doors, you see people staring at computers.
Oh, this is, you know, you're so right. And we have a lot of conversations when we're building buildings and planning space to find ways to get people together just when they have to move from office to office, or even just get to their parking garage so they can interact. And a lot of business gets done in the hallway if we can get people out of their cubicles and out of their offices. But it's not just the workplace, it's the home. And in some ways, the technology is fracturing the family. Everybody is on their own computer, their own device, and they're not talking.
Yeah.
The other day, I actually heard myself saying to my son, Harry, get off that video game and come down and watch television with me. So it reflects my concern of too much repetition of a certain computer task, and also wanting him to come and converse. The other day, I see it in my household. We got two teenagers, and my wife and I were all on our computers doing our work, whatever we may be doing. And the other day, a couple of the televisions broke, and maybe the cable was out. I don't know what it was. And my wife was away, and the kids, you know, were upset. I said, well, come on in my room, and let's have a TV party. And it was fantastic. I mean, we were all watching television, but we had the popcorn, and we were having a lot of fun and conversing. And I think that's a difference we see today. Because there's so much efficiency and what the computers can do, we all just kind of get hooked into our computer, and we neglect our face-to-face contacts that really define our humanity.
Yes. Yes. You know, earlier this year, there was an article in The Atlantic titled, Is Google Making Us Stupid? You probably saw it.
Yeah. Now that I see it, I actually wrote a letter to the editor on it.
Okay.
Because I thought it was a terrific article, but it had a tendency, what a lot of people are doing in this discussion and debate, is taking the negative side.
Yeah.
And one thing that's been gratifying to me when I talk to journalists and producers and other writers and scientists is that they like that iBrain is telling us the positive and the negative, that it's not all good, it's not all bad, but let's understand it and let's deal with it.
Yes. Yeah, and to wit, your research showing that surfing the web actually has some positive impacts on the brain.
Well, it's interesting because when we did this study, I wasn't even thinking of that. I just wanted to try to do a serious study where we could isolate what's going on in the brain when we search online. So to do that, we used the functional MRI scanner. We used these special goggles to present to the volunteers a simulated Google search because you can't get a real computer into a functional MRI scanner. The tube is too narrow. And we also presented to them a book reading page and other control tasks. And it was quite interesting. We found that people who had prior internet experience showed a much greater activation in their brain when they searched online compared to those who had never searched online. And also, it was much greater than reading a book page.
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating research.
Well, thank you. And the other thing that was interesting to me that made sense is that the frontal lobe was particularly activated. If you think about the frontal lobe, that's the thinking brain. That's the decision-making part of the brain. And searching online is a very interactive experience. You're constantly making decisions. Should I go to this website or that website? And the study really reflected that. And it was interesting, the positive take from the media that, the headlines were, Google's making us smart.
Yeah, right. Now, there are a couple of places in the book where I think you imply that that we can take control of the brain's evolution. And I bristled a little bit at that, because doesn't evolution like take eons?
Yeah, I think that in the book I try to differentiate different ways of using that term. I mean, in a sense, evolving can be generic in terms of adapting from moment to moment, and the brain certainly does that. And we saw in our brain Google study that we haven't published this part of it yet, but just after a week of searching online, the computer-naive subjects started looking almost identical in terms of their brain neurocircuitry to those who had many years of experience. So we can see this rapid adaptation that our brains make when they learn new technology. But I think we also argue that it's in future generations we will see brain evolution. And the argument is based on how I understand natural selection as meaning that genetic variants that adapt best to the environment will be those that are most successful. So we know the environment is changing. The average young person is spending approximately 9 hours a day with technology. So if that's the case, those who are really good at the technology will have an edge in future generations.
Yes. But it might take a long time before it
really... Well, I don't know, because it's pretty rapid in terms of the change in the environment.
That's true. The cultural evolution, the whole environmental evolution has been extremely rapid and certainly is impacting us all over the place. Now, you've referred a couple of times to digital natives and digital immigrants, and these might be terms that are not familiar to listeners. So maybe just give us a little snapshot of that.
Yeah, these are terms that were coined about a decade ago to describe the young people who grow up with the technology, are very comfortable with it. They multitask. They're constantly communicating online with their social networking sites and text messaging and instant messaging. They are comfortable with the pace of innovation of technology. So they get a new device every moment. And they've developed lexicons and special languages, shortcuts, that help them communicate very effectively this way. Now, the term native kind of gives that sense of like somebody growing up with a native language, mm-hmm. And I think there is that component to it. The downside of the natives is that they have some challenges with the face-to-face human contact skills. Something's got to give. And there was actually a recent study that found that volunteers ages 17 to 23 who were given a task of recognizing the emotional content of a facial expression, that when they played a video game before that task, their ability to recognize the emotional content of the face was diminished. And I think this is the kind of problem we're facing with the natives. The immigrants are us baby boomers who grew up in a time when innovation meant a touch-tone telephone or a colored television. The pace of innovation was much slower. The amount of time spent exposed to the technology was much less at a young age. And so and they're more reluctant to embrace the new technology, and their brains are a bit older when they get it, so they're not as quick at learning it. So I think this is the, I think it's helpful to think about these two groups. Clearly it's an oversimplification for many people, and some of the challenges of the natives, the immigrants are experiencing as well as the amount and pace of technology penetrates their generation.
Yeah. And, you know, you take a balanced approach where you outline sort of strengths and weaknesses for both groups, and then you have a chapter or more designed for each to kind of direct them for how they might make up for the deficits of either being a digital native or a digital immigrant. For example, you say digital natives lack face-to-face social skills, and you actually have a chapter in your book with advice on getting to what you call empathy 2.0, among other things.
Yeah.
What's empathy 2.0?
Well, you know, I think that what I tried to do as a psychiatrist, I tried to figure out what are some solutions to these problems, and what do we know about you know, another form of technology, and that is how we can teach people to be more human. And there are some exercises that people can do to improve their empathy skills, for example. We know that young people, their ability to empathize, to see the other person's, understand the other person's emotional point of view is not as good as a middle-aged person. So teenagers are still developing their empathy skills. And there are ways to try to help people understand that in, using simple exercises. Another area that's important has to do with frontal lobe executive skills. Teenagers have not really fully developed their frontal lobes, and I can tell you that's the case. I just taught my teenage daughter how to drive, and I had jet black hair about 6 months ago, and now it's getting a little bit gray. So it's, Dad, whatever, I saw that car coming. You know, she doesn't, like many teenagers, it doesn't come natural to think ahead and anticipate. And those are skills that are still being learned. And I think that's a concern, that is you have all this technology that's unregulated, kids playing hours and hours with these video games, are they going to lose some important developmental milestone that needs to be reached at a certain age? I mean, we know, you know, you asked earlier about the plasticity. The young brain and the teenage brain is still developing, and there's this process called pruning where 60% of the synapses, the connection sites between the neurons, are being pruned away. So these neuronal circuits are being shaped during a critical period.
I don't know if you looked into Second Life at all. I don't think that was mentioned in the book.
Well, it actually was, and that's part of the, I believe it was in the, it might have been in the technology chapter or the culture chapter.
Okay.
And this is a very, and you're familiar with this game, or you've
yes,
just read about
no,
it?
No, I've gone into it. I actually have an avatar there.
Oh, my goodness. Tell me about it. What's the experience like for you?
Well, it's very exciting initially, because these avatars, really, everybody looks wonderful in Second Life. All of the women are sexy and curvaceous, and all of the men are hunks. And
so it's a way to kind of reach our ideal.
Yeah. So people
persona are, with the computer, and then for those unfamiliar with it, it's basically a game where you're interacting. These avatars are interacting. I hopefully, you're not one of these people, but there are people who spend 12 to 14 hours a day in this Second Life game.
Yes, I burned out on it. I burned out on it pretty quickly. And it's not really a game. It is an alternate environment, an alternate reality that, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million people are involved in across the world.
There, I've seen, I first was introduced to it. I was flying over the Atlantic, and there was a documentary about it, where there was a couple, married couple, that was playing this game with other people, separately playing it, and the husband wanted to go meet the avatar he had actually married in the game, and that was what the documentary was about. So what's interesting is that there is almost a confusion between what becomes real and what becomes part of the virtual world. And we've seen this in other areas. I've been talking to schools, and we had one of the schools, one of the parent groups, they decided to have a day without technology for the high schoolers. And most of the kids couldn't last through noon. and we had, when I talked about iBrain, we had a panel discussion, and some of the kids were saying, you know, I'm doing my homework at night, and I'm on my Facebook, and sometimes I can't tell which is which.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the reason why I brought up Second Life is we can imagine that virtual reality will get more and more compelling, more and more realistic. Yes. And so...
And, you know, it's an interesting speculation, mm-hmm. because I agree with you. If we continue the way we're going, the technology will really become seamless with reality. I mean, you may go to the doctor and you may not be able to tell, is that a real doctor or a virtual doctor?
Right, right.
The other issue is that how is this going to affect how we understand our culture? Literary reading is on the decline as the technologies take hold. And in the future, the next generation of digital natives may say, you know, I can't get into a novel. I can't perceive what's going on in that protagonist's head. I'd much rather play a video game. So we may have, rather than novels, we'll have video games with elaborate narratives.
Yes, yes. And I've been referring to Google as a prosthesis for my brain. It's become so integrated into my life, our lives. You know, I mentioned I have an iPhone. And so when you're out with people, any question that comes up, you know, where you don't know something, you can't remember a character in a movie, or there's some historical question or something, out comes the iPhone or whatever smartphone the person has. You get right onto Google or Wikipedia, and there's the answer. It's mind-boggling that we have access.
Mind-boggling, yeah. But the question is it changing how we think? And is there are we sacrificing depth for breadth? In other words, we have a new generation that has this, that's constantly getting new information that they want from moment to moment, and they can search online and that's it, and then they move on, rather than looking at questions in detail and trying to understand them. Also, are they learning delayed gratification? If you can get whatever you want, talk to anyone you want to from moment to moment, are we becoming less patient?
I know that I have become less patient as a result of my close relationship with technology.
Yeah, and so think of it, you know, you and I grew up in a generation where we didn't have these tools. We're suffering from these symptoms. What's going to happen with this new generation that knows no other world?
Yeah, these are very relevant questions, I think.
Yeah.
You have a chapter on addiction to technology, and I'm under the impression that experts have been somewhat divided as to whether or not the internet and other technologies can literally be addictive. But you actually outline some relevant brain mechanisms that suggest that, yes, there is an addictive quality.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it would help the field move forward if we could reach consensus on this. There are some internet addiction. And if you look at the behaviors, if you look at people who have addictive personalities, you know, there's the same dopamine neurotransmitter system, that primitive reward system in our brain that operates. And many people have gone from addiction to, you know, they go from food to shopping to drugs, alcohol. Why not the technology? And you see many people suffering with it. In Asia, there are specialized boot camps or addiction centers to help teenagers who are addicted to games, video games. I've gotten some heart-wrenching emails from people who have heard me speak and gotten the book about their kids who are just virtually locked in their rooms with these technologies and they can't get out. Tell me that doesn't meet the criteria of an addiction.
Yeah, I was intrigued by that mention of the Chinese government and their boot camps, and you gave a statistic of about 2 million youngsters in China who were estimated to be addicted in that way. And you also said that the American Medical Association has recommended additional study to determine whether video gaming and internet addiction should be considered official diagnostic categories.
Yeah, and I don't know where the debate is. I know there's DSM work groups right now. I'd be curious as to where the addiction group stands on the technology. So I think it's, you know, whether it's officially recognized or not, it's out there and people need help. And I think the addiction specialists are recognizing it.
Yeah. You also noted somewhere in there that TV is bad for the brains of toddlers. What are the brain mechanisms there?
Well, this is something that's been studied in many epidemiological studies, and there's an association. You find that there's worse symptoms of ADHD associated with more video and TV time, and there's been some debate about it in terms of a true causal relationship, but it's been enough of a concern that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no technology for kids under two. And, you know, I think it needs to be looked at. And certainly in young people, we've seen many improve when they cut back on their technology time. And I'm sure there's some where their brains are not as sensitive.
In your final chapter, there was something that really caught my attention. You touch on future brain and brains interfacing with computer chips and so on. And you even talk about a currently existing neurochip. I hadn't heard about that. Tell us, it's
quite interesting that they're really, you know, nanotechnology is really quite an exciting area where they have, I've seen individual heart muscles turned into machines where they have a little lever and the heart muscle dances around the petri dish. And, we can take individual nerve cells and begin to monitor them. And, you know, I think in the future we may actually have these neurochips in our brains that help augment our memory or treat brain diseases and maybe even used to make us smarter and more seamlessly connected with the computer. I mean, a lower-end technology that's already coming into play is the brain computer interfaces where they have sensors on the forehead or scalp, and volunteers can control a computer just by thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think they either have developed or are in the process of developing assistive devices for people with various paralyses and handicaps to help them overcome.
Yeah, a lot of these technologies develop out of the disease arena, but they can also be used to enhance our abilities.
Yeah, and of course, video games will also drive those technologies as well.
Oh, yeah. In fact, there is a video game company that advertises a headgear right now for controlling your game. Now, whether it's just the person moving their forehead muscles and scalp muscles, or whether it's truly reading their minds, remains to be proven.
Uh-huh. Well, as we begin to wind down here, I'm wondering what research you see is really needed. Let's say NIH or some other body gave you a grant for, I don't know what a large amount of money is in this arena. Let's say $100 million to set up.
Wow. There, now you're talking.
Yeah, to set up a research project of your choosing. How would you spend that money?
Well, you know, I think I would take what we're doing to the next level. I think we do studies understanding how the technologies affect our. We use a lot of functional MRI, which is a great tool to understand how it affects our brains. And I think we'd look at developing technologies to improve our brain function. And this is an area that's already beginning with cognitive training. But I think it's just so much opportunity here. It would be very exciting to create a center or an institute that took iBrain to the next level in terms of research.
Okay. Well, we're kind of at the end of our time here. Is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with?
Well, I would say, try not to get too strung out on Second Life. enjoy the technologies. And I think I have a lot of enthusiasm and optimism that we can harness them to improve our lives, to upgrade our tech skills and maintain our human contact skills, because I think the people who will really excel are those who master both and know when each makes sense.
All right. Dr. Gary Small, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. Gary Small. As he was talking about the dangers of technology addiction and getting his teenagers to take a time out from their techno toys, it put me in mind of one of my sons when he was that age. If ever there were a video game addict, he was it. This was something we used to worry about quite a bit. He wasn't dating, he wasn't socializing much beyond through the computer. Now he's 27 years old, and things are working out quite well for him. He's married to the girl of his dreams, a real beauty, whom he had to pursue for several years, but he finally won her over. They have a nice little cottage in a woodsy area about 45 minutes away from here. As a result of his comfort with technology, he's ended up with a fairly high-paying job in which he's responsible for managing millions of dollars of just-in-time inventory using the Oracle database software, among other things. He was jumped over some people with more longevity, and he's now their manager, despite the fact that he hasn't quite finished his undergraduate college education. However, he's, of course, doing that online and loving it. Traditional education had not been a successful arena for him, but he's thriving in the online environment and very proud of the high grades he's racking up there. When Christmas and birthdays roll around, it's still various pieces of technology he wants, faster motherboards for game playing, bigger monitors, and so on. Still, he doesn't spend nearly as much time holed up with video games, and from what I can see, he's having a very happy marital relationship, loving living in the woods with wife, dogs, and cats. Sure, I might have wished a more straight-line path through college for him, but we each have to find our own way and at our own pace. I'm proud of him and what he's making of himself. I offer this personal vignette for any of you who may have seemingly techno-addicted kids to suggest that it may serve them in ways that you can't presently foresee. This is not to deny the pitfalls Dr. Small outlines in his book, yet most of these digital natives will probably come through with flying colors.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, it's the day after Christmas here at the Van Nuys household. We had a very nice time of family sharing. Happily, my four adult kids, along with a son-in-law and a daughter-in-law and two grandkids, were all on hand, along with a Native American friend of one of my sons. Now, in the aftermath of all the last-minute frantic preparation, it's good to take a deep breath and step back into the normal pace of life. I hope that all of you had a wonderful holiday time as well. I had hoped to have this podcast completed and ready to go by this morning, but understandably, life got in the way. If I can get it out today, Friday, though, I'll still consider myself to be on schedule. Now, speaking of being on schedule, I've been toying with the thought lately that maybe I ought to consider cutting back on these podcasts. I've been producing 4 and sometimes 5 Shrink Wrap Radio podcasts a month, plus 2 Wise Counsel podcasts a month. 6 podcasts a month featuring an interview guest, and each running about an hour or more is a lot of content and a lot of work. Enjoyable work, but work nonetheless. I know some of you have a hard time keeping up with all these shows, and I'm thinking maybe I'm overproducing. I'm oversaturating the market, if you will, especially now that I'm going back to teaching my Myth Dream Symbol course again at the university this spring. I'm thinking it'll be hard to keep up the pace that I've set. So I'm thinking about maybe cutting back to a shrink wrap radio every other week. 2 shrink wrap radios a month plus 2 wise counsels a month would still give you a weekly Dr. Dave show, and maybe that's enough. I'd be interested in what you think about this, so please email me. On another note, last weekend found me speaking to 100 or more serial killer buffs at a theater in San Francisco. The event was held at the Roxy Theater in downtown San Francisco, and was billed as the 40th anniversary of the Zodiac Mystery. Now, I didn't put it together, but I was invited to host it. It's now been 6 years since I co-authored a book titled This is the Zodiac Speaking Into the Mind of a Serial Killer. This is a case that continues to capture the interest of armchair detectives around the globe. I keep thinking that my involvement with it is finished, but the thing just won't let go of me. Many of the enthusiasts out there consider ours to be the definitive book on the case. Without ever having intended it, I have a kind of rock star status in that community, and attendees were eager to have me sign copies of the book. At this 40th anniversary event, I made maybe an hour's worth of off-the-cuff comments and observations, took questions, and then emceed the introductions of the other speakers who had been invited. At the end of the session, attendees, minus me, all got on a bus and took a tour around the San Francisco Bay Area, visiting the scenes of those murders from 40 years ago. Personally, I was glad to escape back to the comfort and safety of my home. As a result of the book and my YouTube video series on the case, about once a month I hear from someone who's absolutely certain they know who the Zodiac is or was. It's their father or their uncle or an acquaintance, or they've put together an airtight circumstantial case against some person they've never met, such as Ted Kaczynski or Hunter S. Thompson, among the more notable suspects. They send me reams of documents supporting their theories, and they're hoping that I can persuade the authorities of the truth of their claims. However, the truth is, I have no ties to the authorities, and the details of this case, which goes back 40 years, are so complex that I can't hold them all in my mind. After all, it's been 6 years since I worked on the book, and I've moved on, and my mind has simply let go of all of those details, the details that would need to be analyzed anew. Well, I just thought I'd share with you a glimpse of this other slice of my life. I can tell you it's been a wild, wild ride. By the way, the current interview in my Wise Counsel podcast series is with Dr. Morteza Kalegi, and it's all about treating the emotional trauma which frequently underlies addiction. There's also a written transcript available on the site at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. As a result of a podcast interview on one of the shows I follow, I discovered a web product that I'm really excited about, and it so happens they also have a great affiliate program. So I've posted a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website, and if you decide to purchase this product, please do so through my link. The product is called Animoto. If you're like me, you took lots of holiday photos with your digital camera. In the past, I've uploaded digital photos to services like Flickr and Shutterfly, among others, so that friends and family could view them sometimes in a slideshow format. Well, Animoto works similarly, and as much as you upload your digital stills to the Animoto site, where you can combine them with music, either your own or the WebSafe music that's available on their site, then you press a button and the site automatically turns your still photos into an automated slideshow with very cool Hollywood-style transitions. If you have the skills and the right software and a lot of time, you could probably do this on your own. But Animoto makes the process so quick and easy that anybody can do it, and in very little time and with no skill level at all. You can produce a 30-second slideshow for free. So I encourage you to go to Animoto.com, that's spelled A-N-I-M-O-T-O, Animoto.com, and see their demo and play around with it. Every time you click on the button, it will create a new, absolutely unique slideshow. As I say, you can use it for free for 30-second shows. For $30 a year, you can produce an unlimited number of slideshows and make them as long as you want. And if you will place that order by clicking on the affiliate link on our site, you'll be making a nice donation to Shrink Wrap Radio as well. We're dependent on the donations of listeners like you. Thanks to those of you who have donated, and thanks to those of you who are about to donate. There's a very prominent donate button at shrinkwrapradio.com, and that takes you to a secure PayPal page where there's several donation options, including the option of using a credit card. And by the way, you don't have to be in the U.S. While your cash donations are greatly appreciated, I'm also grateful for all the other forms of support you offer, including your emails, the comments you post, the voice messages you leave, the volunteer transcriptions, the way you help spread the word, and of course the fact that you listen at all. I should also mention those of you who've advertised on our Top Spots widget, and there's room for more, by the way, as well as those who've taken advantage of the discounts on our website from GoDaddy, Budget, Brookstone, and PetMeds.com. Those discount codes are still there, and they do help support the show. For all of these contributions, I'm very grateful indeed. In the last few shows, at one point or another, you've heard a beautiful British female voice. That's been the voice of Heather Gout, who is relatively new to the podcast scene with her show SNR, The Naked Soul, and SNR stands for Spiritual, Not Religious. As I've mentioned to you before, I've subscribed to her very fine podcast. This is going to be a case of preaching to the choir, but I want to share with you the nice and unexpected promo for Shrink Wrap Radio on her most recent show, which I believe is number 5. Here it is.
I'm Heather Gout, and I want to take the opportunity at the beginning of the show to say thank you very much to Dr. David Van Nuys, PhD, for his encouragement and support. It wouldn't surprise me if a lot of you already know Dr. Dave as the host of the psychology podcast Shrink Wrap Radio. If you don't, I think you should go to www.shrinkwrapradio.com. I could tell you to subscribe. It would be a bit out of character for an agnostic, but I'm pretty certain if you sample an episode or two, you'll subscribe anyway, just like I did. Shrink Wrap Radio has been on air for almost 4 years, and each show has an in-depth interview with a professional whose work relates to the human mind and behavior. I don't know an easier way to learn the history of psychology or keep abreast of the latest theories and developments. So if you aspire to understand yourself better, shrinkwrapradio.com is a little treasure house of insights. Please go. If you're not able to access the internet right now, there will be a link on the Naked Soul website, and that, as always, is at snrpodcast.livejournal.com.
Thanks very much for that resounding endorsement, Heather. The rest of you can all imagine my surprise when I was driving down the road, listening to various podcasts, and I unexpectedly encountered this wonderful endorsement. I liked it so much, I've captured it and put it on my site under promos, just in case any of you out there might want to repost it on your own blog, website, or podcast. Now let's read a bit of email from our listener community. First, we hear from Nir Ben Zion in New York City, the musician who has provided our intro and outro music and who wrote in response to my thank you note for his donation. And he writes, "It's a pleasure and definitely worth it. I hope to have you with me during my commutes for a long time to come. I can't thank you enough for your wonderful podcasts. Have a great holiday season and keep in touch. Nir. Thank you, Nir, and I did have a wonderful holiday season, or I guess I'm still having a wonderful holiday season. I also heard from Paul, the philosophy teacher in Canada, and another longtime listener who wrote, "Hope you're well. I was wondering if you remember the name of the center and director, woman, of it, in California, possibly near Palo Alto. You had her on your show a while ago, and I think you were talking about existential and related forms of psychotherapy. I'm interested in enrolling in the said center and was talking to the said director, but have since misplaced her contact info. Have a great day, Paul." Well, I share this with the rest of you just in case anybody else is interested in this program, and have confirmed with Paul that the session that he was referring to was number 115, Existential Humanistic Psychotherapy and Education, with Dr. Myrtle Heary. Next, we hear from another Canadian listener and two-time guest, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I just finished listening to your report on the Causes of Happiness conference, and I have to tell you how much I enjoyed it. I was in a bit of a funk when I first turned on the show, but within moments my mood improved from just listening to your summary of the conference. Things only got better as I listened to your interviews. I started feeling optimistic and upbeat and genuinely happy again. It's amazing what good can come of focusing on the positive. I was really getting into the interviews when they suddenly stopped. I thought I was going to hear tons more, but I guess your time ran out. I'm looking forward to your follow-up with some of the great people you met at the conference. I'm sure they have much to teach us. As always, keep up the great work." And that's from Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, who is the author of Raise Your Kids Without Raising Your Voice, a book I highly recommend. And you can also find her website at www.parenting-advice.net. And finally, we hear from Jeff, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, big fan and avid listener here in Chicago. Thought you might be interested in this article in today's newspaper. I read it and thought it raised interesting questions about media, clinical work, and patient confidentiality, and you may like to view it as well. Keep up the good work on the podcast, Jeff." And Jeff's article talks about the stress of Christmas leading to more visits to psychotherapists this year than years past. So I guess it's really about added stress of the current economic climate. You can find it by doing a search at the Chicago Tribune on the phrase, "Busy therapists, busier this year." So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I am ShrinkPod. You can use the My Chingo button on our site to record a message. You can send an MP3 recording, or you can leave a message on our phone at 206-337-0622. And by the way, before I forget, I should mention that Shrink Wrap Radio is also part of a network of medically related podcasts, the entire group of which can be found at www.podmed.com or by clicking on the PodMed badge on our website. Thanks to Gary Small for his insights on the impact of technology on our brains. Next week's guest will be Robert Wagner, President-elect of the International Association for the Study of Dreams and author of the new book, Lucid Dreaming, Gateway to the Inner Self. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.